CBSI in the World, I'm John Batchelor. I welcome the author and distinguished biographer Conrad Black to look at the new book that he's issuing now, The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. Volume 1. This is Antiquity to the Caesars, 14 AD. Immediately, I congratulate you, Conrad, saying your modesty did not tell me this book was coming. I've now ordered my hardback copy. I have the digital in front of me, and I've read your preface. Why did you take upon this burden on your shoulders, Conrad? Good evening to you.
Yeah, well, good evening to you, John. Thank you for your kind words. Well, it's a magnum opus, you see. I mean, I started out writing biographies, and I wrote a history of the U.S. and a history of Canada, and now I'm onto a bigger thing, and this is, I hope, the three volumes together will be my big sort of statement, which it's accurate history and also interpretive history. But as when I was in the newspaper business, I'm always clear to separate reporting from comment. You know, and there are historical facts, and then there are reasonable things you can say about the facts. And my real object was, I became convinced that having read the Cambridge Ancient History of the World and the History of the Middle Ages and Cambridge Modern History, a total of 30 volumes of, I would say, an average of 800 or 900 pages each, the average person thinks that it is impossible to get their hands around a serious and readable deductive analysis of the political history of the world, and it isn't impossible. It can be done. This doesn't purport to be a cultural history or a social history or a technological history. Obviously, you have to mention those things, but just how people, when they were tribes and clans, formed up, how that concept grew up into the structures we have now, nations and international organizations, and how the idea of how these groups should treat other groups evolved. And it can be put in three good-sized volumes, and it can be made reasonably readable if you emphasize the outstanding personalities in the course of that time. There have been a great many of them.
Yes, if I read your preface correctly, you're keen on when the periods do not have outstanding personalities, you go quickly, and when they do, you spend time with the individuals who are geniuses to advance political thinking. Do I read that, your observation, correctly, Conrad?
Yes, that's right. And anyone could become extremely interested in someone like Alexander the Great or Julius or Octavian Caesar and many others, so those would be perhaps the most prominent, but and they did make a difference, you know. But this is another point. I'm not an adherent to what's widely called the great man theory of history, because that tends to be a bit idolatrous and worshipful of individuals. But I am an adherent to the fact that people make history. That we don't just sit here and wait for the weather to change or, you know, floods to happen. The fact is, it is the history of man, and the people make the history. And the most important and talented people make most of the history. And it is an interesting story. And the other thing that I become quite militant about is there actually is such a thing as progress. I mean, if you look at the state of the world at the latter stages of the Old Testament, when, you know, history was more or less verifiable, compared to now, no one can say there hasn't been immense progress by every material and human criterion. There has.
You observe one ironic note that made me smile about the Greeks having a very good reputation for being philosophical. However, they treated the Romans badly whenever they came up against them. I've long been of the opinion that the Greeks had a superiority complex that they never really shed. Is that something? I look forward to reading your segment on this. I just wanted a preview. Is that an observation that you found as well?
Yes. I mean, they did they did exceed in they were very successful culturally, and they were trailblazers in political organization up to a point, but they were compulsive war makers, and they could never get beyond the size of a city state. And you know, it was such a contrast with Rome, which started out as a kind of market town, like a miniature Fresno, California, you know, where the farmers brought in their olives and so forth, grapes and things, and they were sold. And it just gradually expanded until it was ruling the whole known world. But the way it expanded was it was provoked. And then once it got going, it recognized preemptively potential threats and dealt with them. But territory it took over, it lowered taxes and improved standards of government and made it a more peaceful society as well as a more prosperous one. And then it took the more prominent people in each community and made them Roman senators. So it sort of suborned the elites, but in a benign way, and gave better government and lower taxes. And so in general, people, after a while, rather liked being part of the Roman Empire, most of them. And then in certain places that it just wanted to keep out of the hands of enemies, it would support a local potentate like King Herod. But Herod couldn't govern without a bit of an assist from Rome, so they'd keep a legion there to help him if there was an uprising. But they didn't have to take on the very taxing task of governing the Jews. I mean, they developed a strategy of government that was far beyond what the Greeks thought of.
And Volume 2 and Volume 3, you're working on them in the future. How will they differ from Volume 1, or is it just the continuation of the chronology?
Well, it's a continuation of the narrative, but as I say, it's interpretive. And I, at various places, I just finished on Henry VIII, for example, and he just announced that he was setting up a new church, and he had been given the title Defender of the Faith by the former Pope because of a piece that really Erasmus wrote for him. And he told Parliament to continue that title for him on the new church that he was now the head of. And there's room for argument about how plausible Henry VIII was as a religious leader, but it was a clever move politically. I've got us up into the nation state now, and I've described Columbus as cursorily, I admit, but his voyages of exploration and others, Verrazano and so on, and Cartier, and the Portuguese going to India and so on. So we now have almost the whole world in focus, whereas at the end of Volume 1, it was just the Roman Empire, India, and China.
The Volume 1 is the political and strategic history of the world from the origins of government to the present. Volume 1 continues to earliest times, to 14 AD, just published by Conrad Black. I'm John Beck.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.